Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Energy Transition Today. I'm Oliver.
I'm Dila.
I'm Viola.
And we are here to give you another week's worth of news and analysis from the energy transition. It's been a busy week today. We've got news coming in hot off the press from Lithuania. We'll be going through advancements in the Spanish renewables market. And we'll also be talking through some of the innovative approaches to grid management with virtual power plants later on in the episode. But before we get into any of that, I'm going to pass it over to Viola with the news. By the way, Viola, it was great listening to the first episode, which I think everyone has listened to now, of Powering Tomorrow.
Thank you, Oliver. Thank you very much. And very happy to be back on Energy Transition Today. I'm glad that first episode of Powering Tomorrow was a good one. Apparently was well received. We've got quite a few lined up for the following months. So if anyone is interested in listening, reach out to us. I'm always recruiting for that one in particular, for sure. So back on the news for this week. So I'd say definitely the highlight of the week came in right at the start, as the Lithuanian second offshore wind tender managed to only attract one bid from Ignitis Renewables. And that was a very disappointing result for the procuring authority, which in fact, as a result of that, the day after essentially declared the tender void and decided to relaunch it from scratch. Predominantly because one of the criteria was that the tender would only be awarded if it managed to attract at least two viable bids, and there was only one.
Okay, so not very good news from that market, but what's happening now on the government side to address this?
So our news editor Maya gives us the latest on this one, and just before coming here today, we've published a story that gives an update from the Lithuania's Ministry of Energy, which is at the moment in the process of finalizing the procurement parameters for relaunching the tender, essentially. So the key there will be to hike the CFD, the contract for difference floor, to ensure the success of the second time around of the launch of the tender. So it's worth highlighting that this was the second, it's part of the same program, but it was the second tender, but the first one that had a CFD tariff attached to it. And more specifically, it is at the moment designed as a two-way CFD scheme with a price floor of 63.31 euros per megawatt hour and a price ceiling of 107.18 euros per megawatt hour. So the government is now saying that it hopes to relaunch the tender as soon as possible, but obviously the timeline will depend on the extent of the changes that need to be done to the procurement criteria. So just a bit of background on this one. The tender was for the development rights to a 700 megawatt fixed foundation wind farm located in the Lithuanian Baltic Sea and follows essentially a very similar one for the same capacity that was awarded previously to Ignitis.
That's a very interesting development then. It kind of fits into what we've talked about a lot over the last couple of months with these tenders going a little bit awry. But can we perhaps dig into what's gone wrong in this case in particular? Why has what are we hearing from the market about why this tender was so unpopular?
From various conversations, I mean, and also from just looking at the picture from our standpoint, I mean, obviously Lithuania is a fairly small market, and it's not necessarily scalable. The tender itself is not necessarily scalable. It's in total between the two programs 1.4 gigawatt. For context, Baltic Power, which reached financial close last year in September, I believe, in Poland was 1.2 gigawatt. So obviously bidding costs are high, and if you have just like two shots at the program, you can't really kind of reproduce it if you fail at the first one. So perhaps some of the international players have looked at it and assessed whether it was worth the effort, really, and the cost, and decided not to go for it. Because setting up a bid is pricey. You know, you need to think of advisors, internal costs. And, you know, if you kind of lose one tender, the money is basically kind of lost. Unless you can use the same knowledge for the next round, but it doesn't sound like there is a next round for this one at the moment, and even this first one is kind of like struggling to like take off properly. Perhaps some have mentioned the geopolitical situation that might have an impact here. Obviously, Lithuanian just, you know, being very close to Russia and then having had traditionally a dependence on Russia. So, you know, it's an interesting one. We'll see how this second, basically like relaunch of the second tender goes, if it manages. If it's, we've seen before that, you know, like perhaps it is all down to the CFD strike price. Yeah, we've seen in the UK, that's also an interesting one to look at the next round, where the price has been increased. Let's see if that makes a difference in the UK. Let's see if that's the way they go for here, if that attracts more bids. I think overall it's important to highlight that, albeit small, the program plays a key strategic role in making Lithuania potentially self-sufficient from local sources. So as the two wind farms, you know, I think some have pointed out, we'll end up covering almost half of Lithuania's electricity needs. So it's a small tender from a European perspective, from broader offshore wind tender perspective, but it's very important for the Lithuanian market. So obviously the government is well aware of that and is hard at work to get this tender right next time around.
Yes, thank you for that. I'm sure they'll be looking at all those issues that you brought up around making sure the cost is manageable, managing the risk profile going forward. Re-examining the sort of structure of the CFD would be a very interesting move, if they move away from this sort of two-way CFD model. That would also be an interesting one to catch up on. Maybe they would go for something more traditional. But I imagine all these things will be on the table going forward. Where does this sit in the sort of broader picture of CFDs and tenders that we're seeing in Europe at the moment?
Yeah, there's a lot coming up. So, you know, we've covered before, we've got Celtic Sea, we've got the Germany tender, the Netherlands, Spain has launched public consultation on new regulations for the sector, which we are waiting to see what that produces. So there's definitely a lot of procurement out there. And in general, talking to the market, especially like lenders are still very keen on offshore wind. They still see it as a buzzing market, despite the challenges that are obviously there, and everyone is aware of them. So supply chain, material costs increase. There are potentially significant headwinds for the sector, but I think banks and investors are definitely lining up for those tenders by the sound of it. So yeah, let's see how they all pan out throughout the year. So in other news, our reporter Aishwarya gave us the latest from her solar remit on by reporting on Spain-based renewable group Brook, which has secured €570 million in debt for the construction of a 842 megawatt solar portfolio in Spain. So the financing on this one will be allocated to the construction of the projects within the portfolio, which is slated to commence operation in between 2024, 2025, so toward the end of this year, beginning of next year. And there's a list of lenders and advisors that is available on our website for our subscribers. So reach out if you want to be set up on a trial, if you are not a sub. And speaking of Spain and solar, Oliver, do you want to talk us through your latest country focus report?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Viola. So the latest country report, as you mentioned, is on Spain. For listeners who have been with us for a while, the last one of these that we did was on Finland and on Norway before that. And we decided to really focus in on Spain for a couple of reasons, not least of which we're going to be in Spain in just under a month's time for our Madrid event, Financing European Renewables, which we're all very excited about. And so I thought it was a good opportunity to kind of dig a bit deeper into some of the stats and take a data-driven view of the market, sort of looking at the projects and deals that are coming through our database.
Thanks for that overview, Oliver. So would you like to give us the highlight? Can you give us a little bit of an overview?
Yes, I certainly can. So I don't think it will come as a surprise to many to know that the dominant renewable sector in Spain is solar. By far, incredibly strong solar market for, you know, just the geography of where Spain is. It makes a incredibly valuable place to do these projects with very high capacity factors for setting up solar plants. That deal that we were just talking about, the Berg deal, kind of really illustrates this, how you're able to get really quite high nameplate capacity for relatively low capex, certainly compared to other renewables, other technologies. Solar is by far the cheapest renewable to turn around in Europe these days. And another reason, of course, you mentioned it's going to be turned around in just a year's time. So you can get these projects up and running, generating electricity incredibly quickly. And just that sort of borne out in the data, we saw just about 60% of all of the deal activity that we've been tracking over the last couple of years from 2020 to today has been in the solar market in Spain. This has been consistently the largest part of the market. When we look at the capital that's being deployed into projects, solar has been the largest sector year on year since 2018, which is when we started breaking down projects this way. But something else that we've seen in the last couple of years is a really increasing focus on some supplementary technologies around solar. So that we mentioned earlier that there is also the consultation out on offshore wind tenders in Spain, which is a process that's ongoing. You know, that's many see that as a very promising future market for offshore wind. But we've also already started to see a lot of movement on batteries, a lot of movement on energy storage to supplement solar as a way of dealing with some of the issues of overcapacity and oversaturation of the market, which is something that we come on to in a bit. And yes, in the last year, 2023 has so far been the biggest year in terms of our logged deal activity in Spain. The number of deals that are moving from the sort of early stage projects into later stage procurements is really increasing. However, there is an issue in the market right now that there seems to be not quite a strong growth in those that are actually making that final step towards a financial close. So there's a couple of reasons for this. So it's seen as a very saturated market. The capacity to build these projects is a natural limiting factor. There's an awful lot of renewable capacity on the Spanish grid. 45% of electricity is already renewable in the Spanish market, mostly driven by these solar projects. And I've not mentioned it so far, but also a very healthy showing for onshore wind projects.
Thanks for that analysis. I think one of the very good features that the country reports bring to our readers is that they do a very good job of mapping out that specific market, both in terms of like the sponsors who are active there, the advisors who are active there, and you know, like how those interact. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Of course, yes. So we've got full tables of the most active players in the Spanish market across three different types of players. So first of all, we have project sponsors, the sort of primary movers of these renewable projects. It's not surprising that right at the top of that table, we have Iberdrola for the Spanish market, huge player in so many of the projects that we cover at Inspiratia. Also on that list, we've also got huge movers like Sonadix. We've got Repsol. I'm not going to go into the list in detail because you can find it all on our website. But yeah, we've got a top 10 of the top sponsors. We've also got a top 10 of the most active advisors, which is across legal advisors, technical advisors, all those companies that bring their expertise into closing deals in the Spanish market. Key names on there like Aldon Overy, Watts Farley and Williams, and plenty more in that market there. And finally, we also have a table of the most active lenders and investors who are putting capital into these projects, as I mentioned earlier. You've got national players there like Santander, very heavy focus on the Spanish market. But also we've got in there some more international players, both on the public and private side. So we've got players in there like the European Investment Bank, ING, a range of different players. And as I mentioned, I'm not going to give you the full lists here, but if you want to find them, they are available on the Inspiratia website.
Thank you very much again, Oliver. And yeah, so Country Reports, definitely a new regular feature of the Inspiratia's editorial content plan. I think perhaps we can say that there is another one already in the calendar on Italy, so stay tuned for that one next month, I believe.
That's right. And Dila and I are going to be working on that one over the next couple of weeks.
That's yep. Right. Get ready to hear more from me next month.
So one of the issues that I mentioned in the country report, which we focus on a bit, is as I mentioned, the oversaturation of the market. And this has been really driven by those low solar prices in the European market right now. And there's a couple of reasons for that. We've covered on the podcast before, Dila has been bringing us the geopolitical view. So Dila, can you talk us through the trade relationships between the EU, China, and indeed the US?
Thank you for that introduction, Oliver. Overcapacity has been an issue that's been keeping everyone quite busy across all those regions you just mentioned. And the reason it's kind of back in the news again now is because the EU has actually launched a few new probes into some of the overcapacity that China is flooding the market with, specifically when it comes to solar panels and wind turbines this time. Loyal listeners will remember that the EU had begun a probe into electric vehicles back in October, basically investigating if indeed there have been some unfair practices ongoing from the Chinese side.
So asking the question of whether the subsidies which some Chinese manufacturers are enjoying constitute an unfair advantage compared to European manufacturers.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, because they can outcompete its competitors, i.e. Europe and the US, it gets to sort of meet global demand quite easily. And because it's basically met domestic demand and it has gone over into over-manufacturing, it is flooding the global market with these products. And here, China basically is rejecting this notion. Obviously, it's basically saying that this is all the result of ongoing technological innovation and its comprehensive industrial and supply chain setup and structures, which is something the commission is currently investigating, as I said. And once the commission does reach a decision, they're expected to move quite quickly on this. I should say not everyone agrees with this entirely. For example, the German automotive industry is a bit apprehensive about these moves that have been taken, basically saying they haven't been consulted enough. And this all goes back to fears over retaliation from the Chinese side, obviously. It's an important market for the German automotive sector in terms of exporting and also manufacturing over there. And this overcapacity issue has now also, it has been an issue in the solar sector already, but now in April 2024, so this month, the EU has actually launched two new subsidy probes into Chinese solar firms, specifically when it comes to bidders for a solar panel park with a Romanian company's venture with the German subsidiary of the Chinese solar power titan LONGi. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing this. Whereas the other bidder that's affected is Shanghai Electric, which is 100% owned by the Chinese government. This probe also falls under a new purview of the EU authority, the so-called foreign subsidies regulation that was introduced last July, and it's basically scrutinizing whether external subsidies are enabling firms to present disproportionately favorable bids, particularly in public procurement processes, and also specifically for public tenders that exceed 250 million euros. Now, wind turbines have also been added to this. So they're really going into all the sectors that have been quite critical to the clean energy transition, obviously. Same fears happening on wind turbines, saying that they're potentially unfair practices going that are disproportionate and basically distort the level playing field. And they've launched a new foreign subsidy probe into wind turbines from China, specifically in five European countries, which is Spain, Greece, France, Romania, and Bulgaria. Well, this is the probe side of things. That's how the EU has chosen to potentially deal with the Chinese overcapacity. On the other side, the U.S. has also been making some moves. Most recently, the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has been on a four-day trip to China, where she has been calling on the Chinese state basically to say, control the overcapacity. The supplies you are producing outpace global demand by too much, and you're basically flooding the market, and none of us can compete with this. But equally, there's been a lot of commentary also saying, well, yes, there might be Chinese subsidies, but isn't that kind of sort of exactly what the U.S. is doing with its Inflation Reduction Act? So obviously, China does reject this vehemently and is also not necessarily expected to roll back its manufacturing capacities here. This also would not be in its favor in any way, just because also China is also struggling with its economy that's not been growing as fast over the last few months, particularly also to its real estate sector, which has been struggling a little bit. I think ultimately, it's clear that these trade relations will continue to cause tension between all these superpowers, particularly the United States and China. We'll see if subsidies are the way to go.
It's super important to keep this in view, because as soon as those probes reach their conclusion, the EU, as you suggest, could start putting these tariffs and trade barriers in place. There's very little out there right now which I think has more potential to completely redefine the renewables market in Europe. So thank you very much, Dila. I'm going to throw it back to Viola now, because we have plenty more news to get through before the end of the episode.
Yes, it's been a busy one, this one. Lots to cover, lots to talk about, which is always always great. So you've touched on the importance of developing the battery energy storage in the Spanish market, and obviously the best space is one that we keep a very close eye on. We have our reporter Ash, who takes care of that one, and this week he's given our readers a very good and interesting Q&A with UK-focused renewables developer Enova. Traditionally, they're mostly focused on solar and battery energy storage systems. Today, Enova has over 60 grid-connected sites under development in the UK, with a combined solar and storage capacity in excess of 24 gigawatt. And in the past year, it's secured permits for several solar and BESS projects across the UK. Now, Ash interviewed the firm's MD for corporate finance, Daniel Mashin, who touched on a very topical point in the BESS industry at the moment, the shift to long duration energy storage. We've covered in one of the recent podcast episodes from another Q&A with Zanobi, who was saying, not we stick into like the 2 hour duration energy storage, long duration opportunities that are very geography dependent. Now, obviously, Enova has a different take on this one, which is interesting to look at.
Yeah. So why do Enova take a different view than to Zanobi when they're looking at this part of the market?
A couple of reasons there, really. So first of all, they do take a long-term approach to renewables investing overall. And with that in mind, they are really keen to maximize the battery's contribution to the delivery of net zero targets. So I think that their view is there is a huge amount of lithium ion energy storage development in the UK. But their take on this is that to go truly net zero, what the UK market needs is long-term backup capacity, which means essentially duration of over 10 hours. So the other reason from their perspective is also that longer duration provides more flexibility. And they did really, you know, they covered the UK government's recent consultation on long duration energy storage technologies. So they called on the government to provide enough significant support for new emerging technologies like long duration energy storage to basically fully decarbonize the UK grid network.
Yes, I think it was really interesting, actually, because in the Q&A, they spoke about some of the things which the government are supporting, since some these traditional proven technologies like pumped hydro,
yes,
which, of course, has the proven record, yep, but has such high restrictions on where you can geographically make it and how high that capacity can be. And yeah, I think there really is a need for a long-term view on this. Yeah, that 10-hour range is going to be crucial.
Yeah, I'd agree. And we'll definitely keep our eyes on Enova and other developers who are already, ready to kind of like venture into that space. I believe as part of this plan, Enova has already signed an MOU with one of the technology providers in the long duration energy storage space. So yeah, we'll be covering that from a news standpoint and bringing you more information on how the financing of that technology is going. And obviously, while we're on energy storage, a bit of an event and webinar plug from my side. So while the next event on the agenda is happening in Madrid next month on the 16th of May, the One after that will be the Energy Storage Summit, taking place in London on 25 June, with a broad agenda covering financing aspects, the co-located versus standalone and duration debate, supply chains impact, as well as an Italy-focused session. And ahead of that, I will have the pleasure of hosting the Energy Storage Summit webinar with confirmed speakers so far from CIBC, Zenobi and Sequant. We will be releasing this one at the beginning of May, so keep your eyes peeled. And if you have any questions about the Energy Storage Summit, if you are interested in seeing the agenda or signing up or just generally contributing to it, do not hesitate to reach out to us.
Yes, put it in your diaries. It'll be the event of the year in energy storage space in London. Thank you, Viola. We're now going to move on to actually something very related to the battery storage space, virtual power plants, which, Dila, you have been looking into in the past week, a kind of combination of many different technologies, energy storage being one of them. Can you give us a quick rundown of what you found in the last week?
Yes, happy to. So I'll maybe just quickly talk through what exactly a virtual power plant is, just because it might not be immediately clear to everyone listening. So when you hear power plant, obviously don't think the traditional power plants you've been seeing around. That's not it. Basically, this is, think distributed energy sources. So think wind, solar PV, hydropower, bioenergy, biogas, EVs, battery storage, all those come together, are aggregated, and then companies who are operating these VPPs, these virtual power plants, are then coordinating the activities of these DERs, these distributed energy sources, to function as a unified power plant, basically. So in effect, they mobilize, coordinate, and optimize, and then channel the energy that is produced by a vast number of small-scale energy producers, and then spread them out for us to use as we would normally.
So it's many, many small-scale smart systems coming together to have a big impact on grid production.
That's right. Energy sources that come together and then produce one giant power plant. So that's it. And then the way the VPPs stand out is because they can quite swiftly adjust power output, and thereby they basically rival dispatchable centralized plants as well. They also combine smart grid technologies such as smart thermostats, electric vehicles, and also batteries, as I said. And then they create a large resource that can reduce, shift, or generate electricity as is needed.
So what is the benefit of having all of these individual items working together as a power plant? What's the advantage of using a system like this?
So in talking to companies such as Flexitricity and Eliza in Finland, we basically summarize all the benefits in this article, but just to run through them quickly. So VPPs can help improve and balance the grid. So, and then they can do it so well that it can actually reduce the need to having to build new power plants and other energy infrastructure, which is typically quite expensive and also time consuming. They can help to bolster grid stability. So they serve to prevent blackouts and also diversify energy resources while also alleviating some of the pressures around supply and demand imbalances, thereby also sort of circumventing some of the intermittency issues some renewable energy sources have. It can also help the grid to meet peak demand and also mitigate strains on conventional energy generation infrastructure. Also, they can be combined with smart grid technologies, as I mentioned earlier briefly. They work together in order to improve the efficiency, reliability, and also sustainability of all our energy systems. So thereby, they are providing the consumer with advanced metering infrastructure, and then also real-time data analytics and demand response system. So ultimately, all of these systems come together and support the communication and coordination between the distributed energy resources within the VPP system and then optimized generation and consumption.
So it's actually quite similar in a way to the way that a standalone battery energy storage system would work in interacting with ancillary markets and sort of working within the system, but on a much broader scale.
Yes, so think thousands and thousands of these DERs coming together and doing exactly that.
Well, that all sounds ideal in a way.
Doesn't it?
I'm going to guess that it's not all that simple.
No, never is, I'm afraid. So there are some challenges, as I said, based on some of the market commentary we've been getting from those companies. But we also consulted JLL Technologies and Brattle for this side of things as well. So challenges include, I mean, they're manifold, really, but just to quickly go through them, obviously participant engagement, always crucial. If people don't participate, there's nothing to generate. And then the next one, technical integration. Obviously, all of these are based entirely on technologies working and coordinating together efficiently and effectively. However, it does require quite significant updates to the grid equipment and the operational practices that are supporting it. System operators will often not entirely trust VPPs to perform with the same reliability as conventional resources would. So there should be an effort to develop the ability to fully utilize VPPs and incorporate them into the resource planning when it comes to sort of combining them with system operators as we're used to. Also the interoperability. Other than that, there's also the economic market structure to consider. Obviously, any innovative technology will have to have the market structure in place that allows for sufficient compensation and valuation of these applications. Problems here could include that evaluations of these VPP technologies could only consider a portion of their benefits, for example. So a smart thermostat demand response program might not actually also account for the energy efficiency benefits the technology might be offering. Obviously, the regulatory framework needs to be considered here, as well as the energy markets at large, as well as the standards and enrollment in these programs. Again, going back to the participation and engagement from the consumers. So it could just be simplified a lot more to enroll. And also if you manufacture appliances with the sort of communications technologies as a standard, that could simplify some of the enrollment issues here. I think to sum up, obviously, it's an extremely useful technology once it can be sort of adopted in a quite widespread manner. And it can play an important role towards a much more resilient, clean and decentralized energy ecosystem. And to do that, we do need to optimize the use we get out of our distributed energy resources and also make sure that we're balancing the grid properly. And it can also help with load shifting as well as demand response. So overall, the benefits hopefully will outweigh the challenges, which can be overcome and will help us towards achieving the energy transition and our way towards net zero.
Thank you very much, Dila. A very interesting one. I really want to get into this when we start talking to people at our energy storage event. It seems like fertile ground for some of the more software provider players to really get engaged in the energy storage and, you know, all those other different technologies you mentioned coming together, bridging those gaps.
I should say the role of AI in and machine learning should also not be underestimated in this, but I mean, those will just be technically, practically flowing into any technology that's being rolled out.
We should put that under every story we do.
Yeah,
AI may affect results.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that update, Dila. We are coming towards the end of the episode now. But before we leave you, we have Viola here who's going to take us through a few updates on the upcoming awards calendar. We mentioned this last week, but Viola, you're taking charge of the awards process. How is that going?
It's going well. Submissions are starting to come through, which is encouraging. And obviously, we are right in the middle of the submission period. Just as a reminder, it opened at the beginning of the month and the deadline is the 4th of May. So there is a couple of weeks still to make your submissions. Make sure you don't miss the deadline. And just the highlights information here is submission period is the financial year, essentially, it's like from the 1st of April 2023 through to the 31st of March 2024. We've added new categories that I believe we have 33 in total. So there's plenty of opportunity for everyone to participate. There's a broad spectrum covering all of the players that are active in the energy transition space, from investors, fund managers, developers, lenders, legal advisors, financial advisors, technical advisors. I believe we even have like software providers in there.
Is that one of the new ones?
Yes. Optimizers. There's even like an optimizer award this year. So like there's really plenty of opportunity for everyone to come in. We've expanded the deal categories as well to better represent the efforts being made by the industry towards achieving the energy transition. And yes, so make sure you do throw your hat in the ring. Yeah, any questions you may have, again, come my way. I'm always happy to help with that.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the ceremony. Biggest night in the energy transition.
Indeed.
Last year's was incredible, and I'm sure this year's will be just as enjoyable. Thank you very much, Dila and Viola, for all of your input on this episode. It's been jam-packed, and I'm sure everyone enjoyed it. Thank you both.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Oliver.
We'll be back next week with even more news and analysis of the energy transition. But until then, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.